Let's Get Corrupted. What is going on, everybody? It's your boy Joe with Meteoric Serpents coming back at you for another episode of the Colubrid Corruption Podcast. Guys, what's going on? I hope you're all doing great this week. The feedback from last episode was awesome. I'm glad that many people tuned in both live and after the replay were commenting on the video. So glad you guys appreciated some of my thoughts, for a solo episode, because those are always challenging to, self-think of, some topics to kind of talk to myself over. But yeah, guys, we're back. Episode number 43. We have a very special guest on tonight. Someone who I'd call a legend in the reptile hobby. He's very well known for a certain group of snakes and not quite colubrids, but he's got a very extensive collection of amazing animals. So I'm definitely looking forward to talking to him about it. We're going to talk about everything, and yeah, so super fun. Guys, and before we get into it tonight, as usual, I do have the Meteoric Serpents t-shirts available. Those and the Let's Get Corrupted shirts with the Rhino Rat on it. I have those on hand, so if anyone's interested, let me know. And if you're tuning in tonight, I'm sure there's going to be some people in here tonight. If this is your first time, make sure you hit that like, make sure you hit that subscribe button here on YouTube. We just passed that 1,000 subscribers mark last week, which is super awesome. Again, can't thank you guys enough. But yeah, we got to keep that train rolling, you know? And if you're listening on the audio platforms, which we're available to listen to on Apple, Spotify, some of the major platforms there, make sure you leave a 5-star review or a 5-star rate and leave a review, and then come over to YouTube and hit that subscribe button here. I really appreciate it. It helps us get the podcast out to more people who like colubrids and yeah, all that stuff. Guys, also social media, you can find me at Meteoric Serpents pretty much everywhere. If you search Meteoric Serpents on Google, you're going to find all my accounts. You could also search Colubrid Corruption and find the podcast pretty much everywhere that way as well. Guys, also, you should support USARC, USARC Florida. Those are the organizations that fight for our rights to keep our reptiles, whether it's as a business, whether it's at just a hobby. Those are the ones who fight against legislation that would take those away. So definitely support. Also, guys, the first link in the description below will take you to the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. That's just another way of added support for me. It's also a way for you to connect with a group of people who really enjoy colubrids as well. Super diverse group of people who keep all different species. And I think it's a great way for you to learn. So if that's something of interest, go check it out. The smallest membership is like $5 a month. So super cool, super way to community build. And yeah. Also, guys, the Colubrid Corruption Podcast is sponsored by the Show Me Reptiles show and Show Me Marketplace. Again, guys, Mickey Meyer, those are the guys who put on Colubrid Fest for us. And if you enjoyed or want to go to Colubrid Fest next year, you should be supporting these guys. Whether it's a local show near you, look it up on the website. I have the links in the description. Check it out, because support those who support the colubrid hobby, so definitely. And then you could also check out Show Me Marketplace, new selling platform for animals, super cool. And then before we say what's up to the chat tonight, we have the hashtag Colubrid Corruption of the Week. And this time I came prepared for once. Oh, let's open this up. All right. Saw this one in my searching. Hashtag Colubrid Corruption, guys. Put this on your Colubrid posts if you want to be featured on an episode. We got this from Solid Serpents. Shout out to Mike. Nice looking gray rat snake there. Super cool. Nice little, trying to zoom in, like red in between the scales. I really like that. He said this guy probably bit him. It looks like it probably did too. So yeah, that's always cool. But yeah, guys, check out Solid Serpents, and on your Colubrid post, do hashtag Colubrid Corruption if you want to be featured. And let's quickly say what's up to the chat, and we'll get into talking with our guest tonight. We got Villarino Reptiles, Emilio. What's up, my dude? Appreciate you being here. We got Adam from Ivory Kluber Co., one of the Patreon members. Appreciate you, my dude. Got Jesse from Musical Pythons. What is up? We got MJ, the Trap Talk Reptile Network. What's going on, man? Appreciate you. And we got Mike from 1776 Exotics. Appreciate you being here as well. And guys, if you didn't see the thumbnail already, I am very esteemed to have Mr. Marshall Mendez on the podcast with us tonight. So why don't we all give a warm welcome to Marshall. What's up, man?
What's up, Joe? How you doing, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to meet you.
Yes, likewise. Definitely. You know, I've been listening to a lot of the All in the Tree Tuesdays. Really appreciate the Chondro content. I don't keep any personally. I definitely like to get into them eventually, but, you know, just really appreciate all the knowledge you drop on there. Excited to have you here tonight. And hopefully we could spread some more knowledge, you know?
Yeah, thanks, man. It's been a lot of fun doing the show. I'm picking up knowledge too from all the guests. It's been a great thing.
Yeah, 100%. All right, cool, man. So why don't we get into it? For those who may not know you, who are, you know, seeing your name potentially for the first time, can you kind of give a background of how you got into reptiles and how that kind of segued into where you are today in the hobby?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, like probably most people who are listening, it started at a very young age for me. I think I was in maybe first grade. So what is like maybe 6 or 7 years old, I got my first snake, which was a Western red-sided garter snake. And I saw it at the pet shop, talked my parents into getting it for me. And so from there, I went on to have traded that in after a few months and got a corn snake. And then from there, it just kind of, once I was in my, you know, late middle school, I had all kinds of stuff, all different kinds of colubrid species, boas, you know, ball pythons weren't really they were around back then, but they were just notoriously, you know, nobody thought they would eat. Nobody. So I didn't have a ton of those at that time. Albino black rats. I remember I had a snow something or other. I can't even remember, maybe a snow black rat. You know, multiple different kinds of king snakes. And then, so that was all through high school. And then when I went to college, I basically, you know, didn't want to be taking care of snakes while I was in college. So I sold everything I had, which, you know, wasn't a ton of stuff, but, you know, for a high school kid, it was a lot. And once I graduated college, started making a little money, I started what is essentially now Red Mountain Herb. So that was in 1998. And, okay. Invested a little money for a couple of years. Was finally able to afford a green tree python and bought, you know, over the course of 2 or 3 years, I bought about 10 animals, all babies, raised them up. And then, you know, ever since the first year that I hatched a clutch, which was, I believe, 2001, it's turned a profit every year, and it's been, you know, I've just, you know, used the money that I've made off of it to, you know, slowly increase things. And now it's turned into essentially like another, you know, I'm not going to say it's a full-time job, but it's definitely another part-time job.
Oh yeah. And from what I hear about Chondro care, especially like babies and all the time you got to put in, I mean, I know, and plus you have a ton of other species there. I mean, you have a pretty substantial ball python collection, I know. So I know you're probably putting that work in.
Oh yeah. It's like, you know, it's 20, 25, 30 hours a week by the time you figure the snakes and the rodents and, you know, yep. My son, I pay him to help me. I have him doing like the kind of the grunt work, you know, he scrubs tubs, sweeps, mops, changes water bowls, that kind of thing. It's been, you know, like I said, it's a grind for sure, but you know, I can't imagine not doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, man. I mean, it was a part of your life for so long. You started so young. So when did, just to put it in perspective, when did you get your first reptile, and when did that collection start going? Because you said like kind of like middle school aged ish.
Yeah, first grade, elementary school. Yeah, is when I got my my garter snake. Okay. And yeah, I just kind of took off. Like I said, took off from there. At first, I just had like, you know, had one or two at a time, and I was always like, you know, wanting to breeding. I think that was kind of like the early ages of people figuring out how to breed things, you know?
Right.
So breeding was not on my radar at that time. And I would just have, you know, I'd have a snake and keep it for 6 months. And then I'd go to the, you know, go to the pet shop with my dad. And then I'd see, you know, after the corn snake, I saw like a red tail boa, and I was like, oh man, like, you know, I got, you know, can I trade this one in and get the boa? And you know, I had a couple, and then, I lived in Tampa, Florida at the time when I was a kid, and I knew a guy who, well, I didn't know him, but I had a family connection with a guy who ran a business called the Southeast Reptile Exchange, and he was an importer, exporter kind of guy. And through the family connection that I had, I started going to his place, and that's the first place where I ever like laid eyes on a green tree python. And I mean, from that moment, I was hooked on them. But he would always, you know, he got in and out all kinds of stuff. So most of the stuff that I got was from him. And it was just, you know, and like I said, back in the early days, I didn't keep anything for long periods of time. I would, you know, want to swap them, and had Burmese, I had rainbow boas, I had, you know, and iguanas, chameleons, just all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you said 2001 for your first chondro clutch. And now I know like the 90s and early 2000s is considered almost like the Wild West of the reptile trade. But, you know, it was a lot of colubrids back then, because colubrids were like the easy thing to breed. Pythons, perhaps not so much. Were you kind of like one of those pioneers really of captive breeding green trees,
or
were they
that
going for a while?
Yeah. No, there, by the time, you know, when I got back into it, it seems like it kind of exploded during the time that I was in college.
Okay.
And that probably has something to do with the internet, you know, coming, the advent of the internet and people connecting that way. You know, from, I had never even heard, you know, thought about breeding them. And I got out of college and started looking for a snake again, and then kingsnake.com, and it's like, holy shit, man, people are breeding these things. People are, you know, started going to shows, and ball pythons were already, you know, a huge thing at that point. Green tree pythons at that time were still kind of trying to be figured out. You know, people were having success, but it wasn't like a, you know, and it's still not a cookie cutter recipe that'll work for everybody, you know? But that was my first clutch, period. I'd never bred anything prior to that. And awesome. That was the first, you know, first attempt at breeding anything.
Hell yeah. Very cool. All right. So in the spirit of the show, I do want to go into what colubrids you're currently keeping today. And if anyone saw the Instagram post where we're looking at subox, which are the Trans-Pecos rat snakes and bull snakes, which to me, I find interesting in your collection, because I feel like it's such a stark contrast husbandry-wise from most of the arboreal stuff you're keeping, because you go from the very, rainforesty type tropical climate to species that prefer to be more arid, and kind of almost desert. I mean, the bull snakes, you know, you find them in Colorado where it's pretty high elevation, dry, all that stuff in that whole region. And then, you know, the Trans-Pecos are South Texas, New Mexico, and Mexico. So I found that super interesting. What made you choose those species over anything else?
Well, for me, it's really with anything any species that I keep or work with, it's all about what the snake looks like. You know, is it a pretty snake? You know, it could be the rarest snake in the world, but if it's just, you know, brown, I'm not going to be interested in it. You know, so the bull snakes, I've always liked their, especially these particular ones that I have, I've always liked the hypo stillwater. The colors are just unbelievable. Their behavior is really cool compared to everything else. You know, pythons, you go in the room, turn the lights on, they don't move. These guys come up to the front of the tub, you know, they're looking for, looking to get fed. They're moving around a lot more active. Obviously the bull snakes, and these have done it less as they've gotten bigger. And I guess they just are more comfortable with being picked up now. But, when they were little, man, they would hiss so loud. Oh, yeah. And do the rattlesnake thing and rear up and open mouth and, you know, stick the tongue out. And, so
they would the blunt strikes too, right? Like closed mouth, just kind of
hit you. Yeah. Yep. And I was always like, man, they can hiss so loud, bull snakes, for their size. So that's what kind of, you know, attracted me to those. The Trans-Pecos, kind of the same thing, but just for different reasons. You know, they're beautiful snakes. I really like the pattern and the colors on them. And their behavior is cool too, man. They're just super, super. The babies are a little bit, you know, flighty and bitey. When you reach in to pick them up or whatever, they'll hiss and strike at you, and they'll rear up too and open mouth and all that stuff. But the adults, once they get to a certain size, I've never been bit, struck at. Like, they're pretty timid snakes, really. A lot of them that I have won't even like tongue feed. I'll just have to leave the rodent, you know, leave a pre-killed or frozen thawed rodent in the tub, and then I come back and it's gone.
Yep.
So, you know,
it's pretty much rat snake behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. You can hand them to kids and they, you know, don't have to worry about them biting. Unlike, you know, king snakes, like the Mexican black king snakes. I used to work with those. I don't know them anymore. But man, like, you'd pick those up and just a matter of time before you got a feeding response bite, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They were way more like, you'd open the tub and they're like, you know, they probably grabbing my fingers. Can't even tell you how many times.
Yeah. No, and it's cool because I've always seen, you know, sub-aughs are kind of that almost like, not that they're weird, they're almost like a kind of niche species because they require those arid conditions, and that doesn't really fit how most people are keeping them, because most people are keeping semi-tropically for most of their stuff. But it seems like you've been doing well. Obviously, you just hatched the clutch. So that's super cool. I am curious now to ask, and I kind of wanted to do it for each species, but how do you have those guys dialed in husbandry-wise on a completely separate note compared to, like, your arboreals and whatnot?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's where I'm at, it's very humid all the time. I mean, humidity in my room usually in the summertime stays, you know, 70%-ish, 60 to 70%. Just with doing nothing. I just put a lot of ventilation holes in their tub and use really small water bowls and keep them on just super dry sandy chips, which are essentially aspen, you know, little aspen chips. And that's really all I do differently. I mean, they're in the same racks as everything else, you know, for the most part, the babies are at least. So temps are pretty similar, you know, I give them a little nitrile just like I do everything else. And that's really all I've done differently. Now, I have had them, you have to be careful, especially in the rack systems. Like, if you have a sticky tub and the water splashes around, you know, if that aspen gets wet or there is something in the cage that's, you know, jacking the humidity up, they'll puke on you. Or if you feed them a meal that's a little too large, they'll puke on you. So those are the two things with the Trans-Pecos that, you know, not issues, but, you know, once you figure it out, you just, you know, don't spill the water bowl and, you know, don't feed, you know, feed them smaller meals. And hasn't happened, you know, in a long time, but those, you know, some of the lessons that I learned as I was just starting to get, you know, just starting to keep them.
Yeah. No, that's super interesting. I definitely didn't know that about the kind of, you know, if you accidentally spill a water bowl, like, they're really sensitive. So that's cool. And I figured you kind of go with the increased airflow because that helps to keep it dry.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I have, like I said, a lot of holes in their tubs, and then I have a fan pretty much blowing directly on that rack.
Nice. Okay.
I've got a lot of fans in my room. I think air circulation is a huge thing, especially more so for the humid stuff that likes it humid, you know, but stagnant and wet is the worst thing you can be. Yeah. Yeah. So I have fans, you know, behind, blowing behind every stack of cages, pretty much ceiling fans. I have oscillating fans. I have fans that blow air from one side of the room to the other. So, yeah, I've found that to be really important.
Cool. All right. Awesome. So I kind of wanted to go through your 101 on, you know, care and all the stuff on the Trans-Pecos rat snakes. Again, guys, this is a species we just haven't highlighted yet, so it's super cool to get someone on to talk about them. Now, you mentioned racks, so you do keep your Trans-Pecos in rack systems?
Yep, they're in like a 24, my adults are in a 24-quart.
Okay.
24-quart rack.
Gotcha.
And, yeah, 24-quart rack with heat rope. It's an animal plastics rack that I've had for a while. And then, like I said, small water bowls, Santa chips. And then as far as for, like, you know, breeding them, I gave them until they were 5 years old before trying. So all of mine are 2019 animals. Okay. And I have a pretty small group of them, 3.3. And this was 24 was the first year that I had tried to breed them. So I think that helped me. Ended up getting all three females went, and I got really large clutches from two of them, which I heard is pretty rare for them. I got 13 from one and 10 from another, which I think, you know, from what I hear is pretty uncommon. The other female was a little bit smaller. She's not as good of a feeder as the other two. And I think she laid maybe 7.
Okay.
There's four morphs. So there's two lines of albino. There's the, I believe they're called Loma Alta, which I don't have any of those. And then there's the River Road albinos, which are two. They're all recessive. The River Road is a different line that's incompatible with the Loma Alta. Their colors are a little bit, you know, brighter, more contrasty. And then there's a Xanthic, which kind of gives them that silvery look.
Yep.
And then there's Blonde, which it's kind of the same colors as the normals, but different pattern. So it's like that's got like what I call the H's. H pattern on the back. The blondes have more of an kind of more circles.
Gotcha.
That almost looks like eyes sometimes. Like, you know, round changes the H's to more of a round pattern.
Gotcha. To me, they look like dumbbells. I see dumbbells when I'm looking at them.
Yeah. 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 Dumbbells, H's. Heard them called a couple of things, but I the male that I used this year was an Axanthic blonde, so he's got the blonde pattern, which is that pile that you just showed. Yep. I think those were all blonde, yeah, all blondes, and then I bred him to all three of my females, so he's a Axanthic and blonde. I bred him to this girl, which is just a normal pattern Axanthic. And I bred him to a blonde female, and then I bred him to an albino. So the albino babies are all just normal looking triple het for blonde, Axanthic, and albino. And then all the rest of them are a combination of Axanthic het blonde, blonde het Axanthic. And then I got a couple, or I don't know, maybe like 8 or 9 double visuals.
Very cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah,
I was just going to say when I hibernated them this year, you know, I don't really have a great setup for hibernating. I didn't think so. The coldest I can get them without using like a refrigerator or something was like put them in the coldest part of my house, and it probably got into the mid to low 60s.
Okay.
But I just put them in an opaque tub, so dark, you know, all the time. And, yeah, got down into the low to mid-60s, and that seemed to be fine. It worked. You know, some people get them cooler, but I didn't find it to be necessary, at least not for these guys this year.
Yeah, so actually that's kind of the method I've done with my Texas rats, because I haven't had a fridge or any real method to brewmate properly, and I'm down in Florida now, so it's hot here all the time. So my method, what I did was I put them in lock tubs, I put them in my bedroom closet so that they stayed in the dark, no food, and it gets down into like, I'd say like the mid to high 60s at the coldest. And that did the trick for them as well. Now, I know it's not shutting off their metabolism as complete as I like, but I like to give them a good flush out. They actually had their last meals like last week, so I'm prepping for that rumination time now. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. That's what I did last time. Stop feeding them at the end of October, let them clean out for November, and then put them away for like December through, I think, February.
Yep.
And these guys are a little weird. I mean, my only experience breeding colubrids before them was the Mexican Black Kings. And I remember I pulled them out of brumation, fed them until they both shed, and then put them together, and they immediately started locking up. So these guys, I tried the same thing, and it didn't work. I put them together, nothing. And so I talked to my buddy Antoine Burke. He's got a ton of colubrids. He's been an old friend of mine I've known for a while, and he's been real successful with them. And he was like, oh, no, they don't, you know, you'll get at least two sheds and they won't start breeding for you until June. So I said, okay. So I just, you know, kept feeding them, and sure enough, man, put them together in June, and they all, you know, male locked with all three females pretty much immediately. And then it was pretty much textbook after that.
Nice. Yeah, no, it's super interesting how some of these animals are with their cycles, because I know there's other species, and forgive me because I'm probably forgetting. I think it was either Chris Painshab was on here or Jake Brotz. They were talking about some species of Pituophis, actually, and it was like as soon as they come out of rumination, you got to pair them like ASAP, because like that's their small window where they have to be paired, and you have to get those locks in or else that's it. You miss out. Whereas I've seen something like similar to what you're saying with the Texas rats. I kind of bring them out, give them a few meals. Sometimes I'll try to put them together immediately, but I don't see anything. And then I'll usually be able to get locks after that female has her shed. And usually the male's having a shed as well. So it's just interesting to see where exactly in the season of that cycle that they actually breed. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. These were in the middle. I haven't bred the Pituophis yet. So still, you know, debating whether I'm going to brewmate them or not this year. I guess they're 2 years old now, coming up on 2 years old.
Okay.
And I'm, you know, like I said, haven't decided if I'm going to put them in the stack with the Transpecos in the winter. But it's sure is nice to have 3 months of no cleaning and no feeding. So I may just do it.
So, I mean, in my experience so far and what I've heard from other people, it's not a bad idea to do it. And interestingly enough, people have tested it with like, you know, their holdbacks versus animals for sale and brumating, like even, you know, that year's hatchlings, seems to not make a difference on growth. It's not like those animals that were up for longer, you know, like they grew faster, or that the brumated animals were stunted in any way, because they would have gone through that cycle naturally, you know? So.
Yeah. In the past, it's always been, you know, I've heard both ways, either, you know, don't brumate them so that, you know, you can get size on them. And heard, you know, conversely the opposite.
I'll probably go ahead and do it
in all of them this year.
Cool. Awesome, man. And then, I mean, so with those babies now, do you plan on raising them up, and with those holdbacks, with those triple hats, are you going to shoot for that like down the line, you're thinking?
Yeah, down the line, I'm going to sell most of these. I've got way too. I mean, I ended up with close to 30. Okay. And I've had a lot of people have been interested in them. I mean, they're not super rare, obviously, but they're, you know, if you go on Morph Market right now, the last time I checked, there was zero available. There was none. So, you know, a lot of people have shown some interest in them. So yeah, I'll probably keep, you know, a trio of the triple hats just to have that project. But other than that, I'm probably going to let the rest of them go.
Cool.
Just because they're not really, you know, like I said, I'm not trying to, everything that I produce is not, you know, the adults that I have are pretty much the same thing, you know, so I don't need more of them. Yeah. And then as far as the morphs go, you know, I didn't produce anything that I don't already have. So.
Got it. Yeah. I gotcha. And with those hatchlings, have you had any issues with getting them to start on food? Have you had any picky eaters that you had to mess around with?
I mean, knock on wood, so far zero. Okay. Yeah, I had, I've got one clutch that just had its first shed like this weekend. Gotcha. So I haven't tried them yet, but the other two are, I think there's 19 between the two litter or two clutches and 100% success rate on feeding them the very first try.
Nice.
Just drop a live pink in there and come back and it's gone, which is freaking awesome. I will say that I was talking to my buddy a couple of days ago. He was telling me he starts everything on frozen thawed, and it's apparently it's a little bit trickier than live. So, you know, when I sell them, I'm sure most people are going to want them on frozen thawed. So I'm going to try that, you know, next time this gotcha. Week when I go to feed them and see how that goes.
Yeah, I think it just depends on the species, and maybe certain animals can be hit or miss. I've had the pleasure of working with fairly easy to get going animals that will eat anything that you hand to them. So Texas rats don't really refuse anything. Usually I'm handing frozen thawed on tongs for a first meal and I'm not getting refusals. But yeah, I mean, some species are going to be a little bit pickier here and there.
Yeah, so I'll try dropping them in and see if that works. That's what I do with my adults. You know, I'll just leave a pre-killed or frozen thawed rodent in the tub, and then I've got a couple of them that will tong feed. But like I said, most of them are pretty timid. So you just leave it in the tub and then come back and they've eaten it. So I may try that first, and then if it doesn't, if I don't have success with that, I may try the tweezers and see if they just need to see some motion or what. I would think though, after five meals, they're pretty much, you know, I can tell now that they're hungry. You know, whenever I come in, they're all at the front of the tub, you know, waiting for me to drop something in there.
Yeah, definitely. Now on going back to your adults, you had mentioned you waited till the 5-year mark. Was that recommended to you? Did you just decide that they weren't ready, or what was the deal with that?
No, it was just, you know, again, talking to my buddy, Antoine, who's kept them for so long, just looking at, you know, sending him pics, telling him sizes. And he's like, yeah, you probably could try these this year, but I wasn't in a hurry, you know? And, so yeah, I just went ahead and gave him the extra year, and I gotta believe that's what helped with the clutch sizes. Cause I think, you know, the average from what I've read on, you know, on online and stuff is usually, you know, 6 to 8. So getting 13 and getting 10, you know, was pretty good. And I think that the female that I was saying was smaller, she had a smaller clutch. I think she had 6 or 7.
Okay.
So the size definitely seemed to make a little bit of a difference.
Gotcha. And yeah,
just,
I mean,
just in these 3 years right now.
Right. No, and I'm with you, man. Honestly, on the colubrid side of things, I think the years of maturity are super, super important when it comes to clutch size. And I think waiting till that 4 to 5 year mark And of course, depending on the species, that 4 to 5 years is that sweet spot. Not to say anything negative about corn breeders, I just think I see some tiny corn snakes that are able to breed at 3 years old. To me, I feel like that's pushing it, and I would prefer waiting till four to get a nicer clutch out of that female, but to each their own.
Yeah. Yeah, same. You know, ball pythons, a lot of people shoot to breed females at their second year. I don't even try until they're three.
Gotcha.
So, you know, I don't feed, I don't power feed. I feed everything on a pretty, you know, conservative schedule. You just can't be in a hurry. It's what I've learned with green tree pythons, yeah. Emeralds. It's taught me patience.
Right. 100%. And now you mentioned you breed your own rodents. I'm sure that helps a lot. Is it mice? Is it rats? Both?
I do both. Yeah. Both. It sucks. Okay. Yeah. Hate it.
Yeah. I feel like most people, it's like a love hate thing. They like saving money on a rat bill, but or a rodent bill, but that work I know is stressful, and it's a lot.
Yeah, do not recommend. But it's like it's not so much about saving the money. I mean, that is you know, that is a benefit of it. And it's also could be, you know, another revenue stream if you can set up a big enough operation, because I don't have any problems when I have surplus getting rid of it. But I'm always trying to just produce, you know, basically just exactly the amount that I need, because I don't want to do the extra work involved.
Gotcha.
But I could ramp, you know, my I wasn't sure when I built my rodent shed, you know, how big to build it, how many tubs I needed. So I kind of overshot a little bit what I need, which is kind of nice, because now every tub's not full. You've got a place where you can shift, you know, shift animals around when you're cleaning tubs. But the main advantage is just not being, you know, not having the whole snake business operation beholden to the rat breeder,
you know,
who all of a sudden they decide they don't want to do it anymore, or, you know, like, whatever, they can only meet at a certain time of the week, and if you miss that, then you're screwed. That's the main advantage, is always just having, you know, I'm in control of it versus having it in somebody else's hands.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know, you know, I'm good buddies with Emilio, and I happen to get my mice from him, and, like, you know, that's one of the main things he talks about, is just like how amazing it is to be your own. And he still gets rats and stuff, but, like, his mice production is, you know, next level. And that
We were talking about that the last time I saw him in it was Daytona or Trap Fest. We were talking about it. He was telling me that how he's got it dialed in.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's super important, man. And I'm sure, you know, if I had the ability to, I'd love to have even just like a small colony of mice, so that way I have pinkies, you know, at my disposal. But can't always. But
you gotta have a place. Definitely.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You gotta have a place to do that. You can't do it in your house unless you want your whole house to stink. You know, you can't clean them enough to where they're in your house and you don't smell it the minute you walk in. You know.
Yeah, definitely. All right, cool. And now, regarding the bull, so you said you just have a pair right now, and it's the Hypo Stillwaters?
Yep.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, those are the super colorful ones. You know, bulls look like a ton of fun. I feel like everyone who has bulls definitely likes getting all the color mutations out of them, and I mean, they're just absolutely beautiful. You can't really beat that.
Yeah, and they're pretty variable too, you know, like these that I have are nice. I really like the Mexican pines, the northern pines, the really white ones are cool. Unfortunately, those are you can't keep them here because they're protected, so I don't have any of those. But and then you've got all the San Diego ones and the albino, you know, the different types of albinos with those. And then I don't know if you know Keith McPeak. He just had some that were, forget what Kingsville Reds or something like that. I think that's what they are. and they were like, you know, super bright red, and some of them have these tiger stripes, which I think is another mutation. So yeah, they're cool, man. They're all super variable, and I don't know if they all behave the same. Honestly, I can't tell you that, you know, I couldn't tell you what makes one a pine snake versus a bull snake, versus a gopher snake, but unless it's just their range.
Yeah, a lot of it is kind of just where they're located, different areas and stuff like that. The bulls are kind of those animals in the mountainous region, I guess, where, you know, Colorado, that region over there. And then, yeah, the gophers, you know, you have your West Coast stuff, and then the pines are kind of East Coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a little bit into the West. But yeah.
Yeah, I love them. They've been great, man. Their behavior also, like I was saying earlier, really cool. The hissing and the rattlesnake thing, and rattlesnake mimicking. Yeah, they've been awesome. So super high metabolism. You know, you get they're a little bit messy. Keeping them on the Santa chips helps a lot. Just because they're, you know, when they defecate, it's a lot, and it's, you know, just within a couple of days of you know, they can turn a freaking small rat into a pile of mush, you know. And yeah. The Santa chips helps, but they're so active that if you don't have the Santa chips, that kind of the Santa chips will, you know, coat the poop, right. So that it keeps it from at least spreading around. But they're so active, they crawl through it, that just gets, you know, gets all over everything.
Yeah, I feel that. That's a colubrid for you. Just that's colubrids.
Right.
I like doing that.
So other than that, that's why I was telling you before the show, like, I wouldn't want a ton of them just for that reason, but having a pair is perfect.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think the between brumation and faster metabolism, I think for keepers of other species, I think that turns some people away from colubrids. Like those two factors. And sometimes being like small and wiry, especially as babies.
Yeah, Amazon tree boas are kind of the same way. They're like the colubrid of tree boas in that feed them and they poop a lot. Faster metabolism. They're also pretty wiry, you know, flighty. The bull snakes were really, you know, I say bad. It's kind of why I liked them when they were little, as far as all the defensive behaviors, but that's kind of gone away as they've gotten some size on them and they're just used to me reaching in there and picking them up.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. And then let's see. I think that's kind of it on the colubrid side of things. So I do obviously want to talk about the rest of your collection and what's going on over at Red Mountain Herp. Let's kind of jump into the chondros, because that's obvious. That's number one on my list that you're working with. And obviously you're one of the top guys in the game, no doubt, with the chondros. I know you have a pretty large collection. You keep a lot of holdbacks, from what I hear. You don't like to sell a lot of animals, and have done some pretty impressive stuff. So if you want to kind of just spew a little bit about what's going on the chondro side of things in your collection, you have the floor.
Yeah. So I, you know, the last 7 or 8 years, I have not sold very many. Maybe, I don't know, one or two. But I've been trying to build numbers up. I don't have a huge, a ton of them. I probably have, I don't know, under 30 total, including babies. But yeah, they've always been, you know, they're what always been my favorite snake ever since I first saw the first one. They are a little, you know, obviously trickier than some other species. They do have some, kind of, you know, traits that are, you know, the prolapsing, they're prone to respiratory infections. I think most of the respiratory is are due to not keeping them properly, keeping them too humid or too, you know, too wet, cold, stagnant. The establishing of the babies is really hard. Sometimes, you know, it can vary by animal, it can vary by clutch. Sometimes you get lucky, all of them eat on the first try. Other times, you know, they're all, you know, what green tree python keepers refer to as runners, where you try to offer them food and they jump off the perch and run away. A lot of that is probably because we're not offering them the right type of food as babies. You know, they're not eating pinky mice in the wild. MJ's actually had some pretty good luck with feeding them crested gecko babies as a first meal, kind of as a last resort for ones that, you know, won't eat rodents. Most of the stuff I work with, I have a couple of different lines. Versace is a snake that I've had for, I think he's 23 years old or something like that. He's he sired a bunch of stuff for me. He's the sire of the, I have an albino chondro that he's a het for albino. And then I work with the calico line and the tiger stripe line. Yeah, that is that's an albino. That's the albino. Yeah.
And the albino chondro, I mean, I remember when I was listening and I was following you when I was going on. I mean, it's a pretty impressive feat because there's not many of them out there. And if I'm not mistaken, you have produced them before, right?
Yeah,
before quite a this few. One. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I've produced, I'm not sure, I've kind of lost count, maybe 7 or 8 at this point, but prior to this one, only one of them has gone on to establish and do well. And it lived to about 2 years, and then it had some kind of blockage in its digestive tract, and I ended up losing it. Shoot. I think that was due to complications from trying to do surgery on it more so than what was actually the problem.
Okay. Got it.
Good.
No, I was going to say this round on the albino one, I remember you saying kind of had a bit of a rocky start, but as far as it looks now, it looks like it's doing well.
I mean, yeah, you know, as much as you can say that about baby chondros, doing great, shed 4 or 5 times now, eats like a champ. I mean, the thing you worry about animals of this size mainly is prolapse more than anything else. And that could, you know, you just never know. They don't really show any signs of it ahead of time. You just walk in, open the tub one day, and it's prolapsed. So
right, yeah,
that one is a calico tiger stripe pairing that produced that one. The calicos are the ones that are, I don't know, they're one of the older bloodlines, kind of one of the first designer lines, but they have a variety of different looks like that. Most of them have some degree of melanism, black scales. Some of them are high yellow. The main thing with them is contrast. They'll have, you know,
this thing is just nuts.
Yeah.
It's just so
that's
nuts.
An old pick. That's an old pick I have, but yeah, it's, that was a nice one. The melanism, the high, you know, high yellow, there's high blue, there's, you know, there's just a million different phenotypes for the chondros, and they're super variable. And they're not like, you know, your traditional recessive, incomplete, dominant morphs. They're polygenic morphs. So it's like not like a, it's not as easy to repeat as it is for, you know, ball pythons or anything that you're dealing with, just a typical morph, which is, you know, a recessive or incomplete dominant trait.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say what you guys are doing over on Tuesday nights on Trap Talk. I mean, I think you guys are really pushing a movement of people liking and getting into chondros. I mean, I want one just from watching all of MJ's shows over the last couple of years, you know. I'm going to get one eventually. It's just a matter of when. But they're just so cool and so variable. And that's what I love about snakes. I love being able to kind of take a guess and be lucky with variability and just get super cool animals out of stuff and not knowing what's going to happen. I'm super into that. And I love contrast as well. And I love seeing what some of these animals look like. So yeah, it's definitely something I want to add to my collection eventually, whether just as a pet. Maybe I'll try my hand at breeding eventually, but like, I definitely want one as a pet first and see how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, the Tuesday night thing's been great. I think it's kind of helped. You know, I think a lot of people, there's a lot of bad information out there about them, you know, as far as like how hard they are to keep and how, you know, which they're tricky compared to some things. But once you, you know, if you understand the basic concepts, they're really not that hard to take care of. The complication with them comes in with the breeding. But I think, you know, the Tuesday nights have been a good way to bring people in who are maybe like on the fence or, you know, don't really know much about them. So that's been pretty enjoyable. You know, and like I said earlier, you know, I'm learning too. There's just a million different ways to get to the end goal with them. And everybody kind of has their own little take on it and does things a little bit differently. So it's been 100%. Interesting, you know, to hear how different people do things, which could be, you know, vastly different sometimes, but both people have success, you know?
Yeah. And how have you felt like knowing that, I don't know, like giving yourself a podcast platform, like it has an effect on people. I mean, what does that do for you as a keeper? Cause you're kind of just spreading this wealth and giving this information out, you know?
Yeah, no, it helps. I mean, obviously it's good for me if people like, want to get into green tree pythons, you know, even though I don't have any for sale right now, you know, that's going to change eventually. And you know, the more, you know, the stronger the market is and the more people are interested in them, it's just good for the species and, you know, good for, people who are breeding them and, you know, put in the work to do it.
100%. Yeah. Yeah, it's just super cool seeing what you guys are doing over there. Been really enjoying the episode. So that's super cool, man.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good to hear.
Yeah. Especially for, as a non-chondro keeper, like I appreciate the content and listen to it as well. So yeah, I'm sure there's more people like me that are doing the same.
Yeah. Like I said, that's good to hear. We need new people.
Yeah. Awesome. Let's see. Oh, I did want to ask. So I know you're working a lot of designer stuff. Do you have locality stuff as well? And if so, what's your zero?
No, I don't have any locality chondros.
Okay.
Pretty much all designer stuff for me. Just, you know, I don't think I've brought a new, well, up until here in the last month, I did a trade with a buddy and have a new snake in quarantine, but this is the first green tree python I've probably brought into the collection in, I don't know, a while, 10 years probably. Okay. So everything that I have is just, you know, my own stuff that, you know, a lot of it goes back to those first, you know, snakes that I purchased in the late 90s. And right. started the collection with, you know, just multiple generations of those. And I like localities. They seem to be, you know, a lot of people are seem to be getting into them now. And with the new people coming in, a lot of people want to go that route. And, you know, I like them. It's just, you know, for me, I'd rather see a designer in the cage than, you know, like I said, I'm limited to space and how many I can have. Right. So, you know, I've always tried to be somewhat focused with the projects, be it chondros, ball pythons. You know, the more you focus on one thing or one, you know, one, say, morph or a combination of morphs, it just makes your, you know, it's, you can take that project further if that's where all your focus is on versus being scattered out all over the place. Okay. Yeah.
Now I'm curious.
That's what I've pretty much done with the ball pythons. You know, they've all Ultramel, Clown. Now at this point, my whole collection is everything is at least double recessive. Most things are visual for one, het for the other. So it, the whole thing's kind of plug and play. Cool. But I know, conversely, I don't produce a ton of variety. Everything is, you know, everything is related to that project.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was telling you before the show, that's kind of what I've, concised my ball python collection down to, just cause I wanted to work with other stuff, you know? So, I think that's good, on multiple factors. One, it means you're not just like producing stuff just to produce it. It all has a purpose, right. Stuff that you want to do with it, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And when it comes to the conjurers, I did find it interesting, you know, so you haven't brought in a new animal besides this one in like 10 years. So when it comes to pairings over that last 10 years, like just your mentality. So are you repairing the same animals all the time? Are you taking new animals and plugging it into like a new male with a different female every year, giving some stuff off sometimes? Like, how does that kind of work in your brain? Because this is interesting, because a lot of people are always just like, I need more, I need to bring in new stuff, no matter the species. So I'm curious to hear about this.
Well, for me, you know, the albino chondro has been a big focus. So my snake that I was talking about earlier, Versace, who's 20 something years old, he's my only 100% het male. So okay. I pretty much have two projects. I have the albino chondro, Versace line, which, you know, he throws all kinds of different looks. You know, he can throw the blue and black snake that you showed earlier. Those are his. He can produce high yellow, a lot of melanistic stuff. So he variability is all over the place with him. And then, for any Versace female that's an offspring of him, I'll always breed him to the female for the first breeding, just because I'm trying to flush out if she's het or not, het for okay. albino. So if she's not het, then I'll switch something up. Then the other project I have is my calico tiger stripe, which those are now kind of, they started off separate, but due to, you know, losing older animals and stuff, now everything that I have is calico tiger stripe. So I try to keep those kind of together, and I try not to breed sib to sib. Although I do it sometimes, most of the times it's, they're probably like half sibs.
Okay. Got it. Makes sense. Cool. Yeah. I mean, no, that makes a lot of sense. And the reason I was asking is just because I feel like in other segments of the market, which includes like ball pythons, like people are very quick to move on from like their proven breeders and not really work stuff in their own collection. And I mean, it's true for me too. I have a proven breeder for sale. But like they're quick to move on. Whereas you're kind of really sticking, you know, digging your feet in the dirt and sticking with your animals for the long haul.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different mindset too, because with ball pythons, you know, your babies are always your best ones. The babies are always going to be more genes than the parents. You know, it's, you know, when you're pairing the parents together, you're shooting to advance the project, and that's always going to be, your babies are going to be your best one. So unless you want to keep buying racks, keep building the collection, you've got to sell the proven breeders. I mean, there comes a point when they're really not as valuable to you anymore.
Right.
As far as, you know, for what you're trying to do. You got to make room for the up and comers. So, you know, I sell a lot of adults. Just like I said, I'm limited with what I've got now as far as how much time I'm spending, and, you know, more snakes means having to breed more rats. And, you know, more time spent. So I'm not adding any additional cages or tubs. Gotcha. So for me, it's either get rid of the adult proven breeders or sell the babies, which are, you know, the nicer ones. So, but with chondros, it's a little bit different. You know, there's not multiple genes involved. The babies aren't always the best. So it takes a lot longer for them to mature. You know, they adults don't tend to do as well when you move them around. So there's a lot of reasons to not do that with chondros, emeralds. You know, the main thing is this, it's the morph, you know, the morph aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like a, other than the albino, which is kind of a weird thing for chondros. They're not recessive and incomplete dominant traits.
Yeah.
So, you know, the babies are not always the best, and the adults, you know, like I was saying earlier, just as long as they take so long to mature that, you know, adult females are really valuable to you as the, you know, person who raised them.
Yeah, of course. Cool. Awesome. And then kind of shifting over to South America, you got your emeralds and your Amazons, which yep. are also super cool species. You know, I mean, I've seen definitely cool emeralds. You obviously don't quite see the true like variance in colors like you do with the chondros per se.
Right.
But the Amazons are like a freaking rainbow. I've actually taken a liking, you know, just looking at them. I don't think I'd keep them, but like just looking at them, I mean, there's so many cool Amazon tree boas out there.
Yeah, they're highly, highly variable. A lot of colors, a lot of patterns. Like you were saying, the emeralds, not so much. They're all basically green and white, although there is some variability. You know, the green can vary from emerald green to real dark, almost yeah. black. It's kind of like grass, yellow, green. The main thing with them, especially with basins, is the pattern. You know, how much white do they have? What does the white look like? Right. Is it a textbook pattern with a stripe and crossbars, or does it have a, you know, a thick stripe with no crossbars, or, you know, some of them that, like, you know, Ed Marino, those guys are producing the snowflake line, or, you know, they have, like, looks like they're airbrushed and they have a, you know, a 10 scale wide stripe. So the thing with them is more so, you know, the amount of white and what does the white look like?
Got it.
So there is some variability, but it's not like the chondros where you can have some that just look completely and totally different from each other. A super high melanistic, a blue line, a high yellow, that look completely different from each other.
Yeah. And just to pull up some of these guys.
Yeah. So those are Amazon basin emeralds, or that's an Amazon basin emerald.
Okay.
There's two species, basins and northerns. Yep. Northerns are Corallis caninus, and these are Corallis batesii. The northerns have a little bit of a different, head scalation, and then different patterning. And then I also do some that are crosses. So like 50-50 okay. basin emeralds, or I produce some 75%, 25%. Don't have as many of those anymore. I do have one adult pair that I've had for, I think they're 07s. So they're whatever that would be, 18, 17 years old now, something like that, 16. But I haven't produced a ton of them. I produced way more chondros over the years than emeralds.
Gotcha.
Had a couple of nice litters of basins. And then the Amazon tree boas, I'm pretty new with them. I've had them for maybe 6 or 7 years, 8 years now. I've been working with them, and I've produced maybe 4 or 5 litters, something like that. And they're cool just because there is the morph aspect to it. And like you're saying earlier, they're so variable. Even within one litter, you can have, you know, all kinds of different looks.
Yeah, and I've seen on the, you know, the Amazon tree boa episodes you guys have done, and some of the pictures you pull up from some of your guests. I mean, and I look at your page too, and I'm just like, holy shit! Like, you know, some of the, like, even these guys, like, so
yeah.
different, you know?
Yeah, that female, that's a what's called a calico, and the male is a leopard. So the leopard is believed it's a recessive trait. So is calico. So that one is pretty unique in that most of them don't turn that solid black. She's just, okay. She started off when I got her, she was like a typical calico, kind of a lot of red, super bright red, a lot of, you know, some white on the pattern. And then over the years after she's been gravid a couple times, her color's darkened and she's turned to this almost solid black color.
Interesting. You think that's some kind of like hormonal effect as
a
female?
Yeah, I think so. I think all of them tend to darken up when they're gravid. But some of them don't keep it. You know, they kind of fade back and forth.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, guys, by the way, Marshall's Instagram is in the description. So if you're not following him, you absolutely should, because you just scroll through here and it's just quality animal after quality animal. It's pretty dreamy scrolling through your page, man.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, it's all good stuff. Yeah, I mean, you've built yourself quite a collection. Definitely something, you know, to be proud of there, because I mean, these animals are just amazing. And working like with stuff like this, I'm sure it's awesome for you on a daily basis to get to see them.
Most of the days, yeah. You know, the days when you don't feel like going down and cleaning or, you know, whatever, those days are not that fun. But, that, you know, that's what happens when it kind of turns from hobby to pure hobby to business, you know. You have to do things, you know, when you do. And I don't have a huge collection. I mean, some people would think it's huge, you know, that are not in the game, per se. It fluctuates. It's, you know, right now with it being baby season and having all these Trans-Pecos rats and the ball pythons are out, total collection size is probably close to 300 right now. But before all the babies started hatching for the year, I was down around a little under 200. So, you know, it fluctuates, which is not, you know, that's not a ton compared to people that have, you know, 500 or 1,000 or 1,500. Yeah. That are producing, you know, 100 plus clutches of ball pythons a year. But even, you know, with the size that I've got, you know, I'm doing all the, I don't have employee, you know, it's basically just me doing it. So right. I'm limited as to, you know, to scale it would require more time that I don't have, basically.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then kind of lastly on the ball python side, you said mostly Ultramel Clown, right?
Yeah.
Projects wise.
Yep. Ultramel Clown. And then, you know, I'm working on getting various incomplete dominant genes into those. I do have some other stuff. I have like some double head ultra pieds that I've been, you know, I did a couple pairings of those maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I've got just females that I no plans for them. I thought I'd raise the females up and just, you know, maybe try to buy a nice male down the road. But, you know, with the ball python market's kind of slowed down a lot over the last couple of years. And, you know, I'm not going to get totally out of them, but I'm trying to scale pretty far back from what I had, you know, in the last couple of years. I'm trying to get down to maybe 25 adults, something like that. Versus, I think right now I'm probably pushing 100.
Okay, that's pretty drastic.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it's not, you know, it's got to make, if I'm going to do it and it's going to take all this time, it's got to make sense from a number standpoint. Otherwise, you know, I can be happy keeping 25. I don't need 100 if you know, if I'm having trouble selling them, or, you know, plus I don't really want to, you know, if there's an oversupply of them, there's no reason to make more, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, what's your take on it? What do you think? Cause I mean, I see it too. What are your thoughts on where the ball python market is at as a whole? My kind of take right now is like, you know, people don't want to spend a lot of money right now. There's probably a bit of an oversupply. And I think, you know, I said this in a group chat I'm in, I think people need to focus on pairings that they care about and that they want, and stop doing pointless ones that they think they could sell. Because right now there's just not a lot of animals moving. The numbers have been sitting like at between 39 and 40K for like a good while now. Yeah. I'm glad it hasn't spiked up like last year. It was up to like, what, 60K around this time, or maybe in the next couple months last year. But it's been kind of hovering there and really not moving. It's been rather stagnant.
Yeah, I think, you know, COVID happened. A lot of people brought a lot of people into it. They had extra time on their hands, you know, couldn't leave the house or didn't, you know, couldn't go out, couldn't do things that they normally would do. So that, you know, made them have extra money. And I think that brought a lot of new people into it. And a lot of people who, you know, maybe thought that it was, you know, going to be an easy way to make money. And for a while there it was. You know, 2 or 3 years ago, I was barely having to advertise anything to sell it. And now, you know, the kind of the bubble sort of popped. And, you know, prices took, you know, depending on the project, obviously, you know, the most top of the line is still bringing good money, and there's people that'll pay for it. But all the kind of mid-tier stuff, has the you know, the what you're able to sell them for has kind of nosedived over the last couple of years, at least for me.
Yeah, definitely. You know, even animals I hit this year that are relatively powerful, like I stupidly thought that they would like fly quickly, because I got a few posted right now and like I haven't had a lick of interest, and I'm just like, okay, I thought this project was cool and people were all about it, and not even as much as an inquiry. So I'm like, okay, that's eye-opening. That's interesting, at least. And I'm not, you know, I've only had it posted for what, a couple weeks now, but, you know, I'm going to sit and wait. But I don't think it's the end of the world, but I don't know what I expected, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the only people that are spending money right now are the ones where you can get, you know, good deals. Morph market auctions, yeah. are selling, you know, but it's kind of a risk. You know, you throw an animal up there, depending on what week it is, the same animal can bring, you know, 50% less than it did the week before.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, but auctions do work. They have been selling on auctions pretty consistently. Some things seem to do better than others, but yeah, as far as just, you know, regular inquiries and people buying a snake not on auction, few and far between these days for the ball pythons, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll see. You know, ball pythons have the market's gone through ups and downs over the years multiple times that since I've been doing it. I think I've seen the market, like, you know, crash 3 times now. It always seems to come back.
Oh yeah.
You know, will it come back as strong as it was post COVID? You know, I don't know. Probably not, if I had to guess. But, you know, again, it's just a guess. You never know.
Yeah, and you know, I see your comment, Mike. I'm not sitting here worried about anything, because I've limited myself so much that, like, even next year I'm doing 3 pairings for ball pythons. Like, you know, 3 clutches of ball pythons in reality is like a walk in the park. And if, you know, if it takes a little bit to sell a few animals here and there, like, okay. But 3 clutches is a lot different from guys pumping out 100, you know. So
yeah,
that's when you start to sweat a little bit, when you can't sell quickly.
Yeah. I did the past couple of years, I've been doing around 25, and this year I was shooting for 10, and I think I'll end up with 8 or 9.
Okay. Nice. Cool, man. All right. Now getting into some of my wrap up questions here. So you've been into reptiles for quite a long time. You've been doing this for a while. Even with all this you know, talk that's going on, whatever, with the economy and, you know, gloom and doom for the reptile industry. What is it that keeps Marshall Mendez going when it comes to reptiles? What is it that keeps that fire lit?
I would just say it's a, you know, passion, love for the animals. That's the number one thing, you know. I would, you know, it's a part-time job for me, but if the money wasn't there, I would still do it, probably, you know, definitely not at this level as far as just the numbers and the amount of time that it takes up, but I can't, you know, see not having any snakes, you know, so that's the main thing. You gotta love doing it. Everybody that I know that's been, you know, kind of a lifelong keeper breeder, it's that they all feel the same way. You know, if you can't sell them, you would just do it, but you would still do it, but you would do it at a you know, smaller scale. So, you know, that's the main thing for me is just the enjoyment of keeping and breeding.
I hope you guys heard what Marshall said, because it's what I say all the time. Like, if you had to get rid of everything tomorrow, you wouldn't get rid of everything. You know, the passion for the animals has to be there, and you have to really be about it. And if you had to cut down a bit to get the numbers down, like, there's still animals you would keep, you know?
Of course. Yeah. That's what it's, you know, that's what it's all about. You got to have a passion for the animals first and foremost. If you're looking at it as a business or, you know, as a way to make money, it's okay to do that and you can do that, but that can't be why you're doing it. Anybody that I've ever run across that's gotten into it for that reason, they usually don't last long. You know, they'll come in and eventually they burn out, or they realize it's not as easy as they thought, or, you know, it's more work than they thought they were signing up for, or, you know, whatever. So you got to have passion for the animals, number one.
100%. Yeah. And now, circling back to colubrids, so are there any species, whether or not you can or want to keep them at this time, are there any that have piqued your interest over the years that you would consider keeping, or that maybe you even are thinking about bringing into the collection?
Yeah, I think I've always liked the California or Arizona Mountain Kings. Those would probably be my next next thing I'm looking for. And then what else? The rhino rat snakes, which I think we talked about earlier, before the show started. Those have always been up there. I do have a California red-sided garter, which are I had a pair of them. I unfortunately lost the female. But those are the ones that are, you know, like electric blue and red.
Yeah.
Those are awesome. They're awesome. I just have the male now. And what's kept me from getting, trying to find a female for him is just the, you know, I heard the babies are a real pain in the ass to get started, as far as like you have to, you know, chop up worms and chop up pinkies. And they're so tiny. That's what's kept me from.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people do with garters. It's kind of like you almost give them a bunch of chopped up food on a plate. You leave it in the tank, and while they cohab, they're all going to like swarm the little plate with food.
So, you know, maybe eventually find a mate for the one that I have. I like some of the different Pituophis species. Like I was saying earlier, the Mexican pines are up there. But I don't, you know, I gotta be somewhat careful. I don't want to get a ton of snakes that are so, you know, they're not that they're hard to take care of, but man, green trees and emeralds are so much less maintenance. You know, they don't poop as much. You're doing different stuff. You know, you're making sure your humidity's right. You're not feeding as often. You're not cleaning as often. So I don't, you know, I've got X amount of space and time that I want to commit to colubrids but that's it. So to bring something else in, I got to get rid of something that I've already got.
Okay. Gotcha. I'm biased for sure because rhinos are like peak for me, but I think just because of how much you work with the chondros and emeralds, basically same kind of care. I would say not as like wet as you keep your baby chondros, like with the damp paper towel. Maybe a little bit more complex setups and whatnot with hides and whatnot, and a little bit cooler, but like rhinos would be perfect. They fit your niche of like, it's a semi arboreal colubrid. They like the water a bit too. So I think that's something just based on your collection that you would enjoy.
Yeah. And I like stuff that's not super common, you know, because that makes it easier when you breed them to sell the babies. You know, if you're producing stuff that there's a ton of, you know, they're just harder to sell at any price, really, you know?
Yeah.
I have heard that the rhino babies are kind of a pain to get started.
So yes, they can be. We talked about that a little bit beforehand too. A lot of babies you're starting off with throwing rosy red minnows in like their water bowl and them going after that. And then eventually you're able to drop a pinky in there. They take that too. And then eventually you're able to transition them to pinkies. I don't know of anyone, and maybe I just haven't talked to enough people that are able to get them going like first meal straight on pinkies. Maybe some people have been able to transition them a little bit faster. They also hatch very small and like skinny. They're very dainty, tiny animals. So that pinky looks like a giant lump in them when they're able to take it. Once they get going on pinkies, they're pretty hardy. They're pretty indestructible.
Yeah, it's probably like chondros. You know, once you get them going, then, you know, once they're established, it'll take you, you know, you could feed 20 of them in like, you know, 30 a minute, you know, just once they're sight feeding, it's just bam, 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 bam. Super, super easy, easier than even ball pythons once you get them going. But, you know, putting in that time to get them established and having to deal with the ones that, you know, or runners, or you have to assist feed them, or, you know, whatever. Once you get over that hump, they become really easy.
Cool. Awesome. And then, so we're going to circle back to colubrids again for this question. It's kind of usually my last one, but what would you say, or what's your elevator pitch for someone who's looking to keep a Trans Pecos rat snake for the first time, whether it's a brand new keeper in the hobby or someone who's just getting into colubrids? Let's say it's one of your, you know, friends that keep arboreals and they want to keep a colubrid for the first time. What's your elevator pitch for them?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the coolest thing about them is their behavior. Their temperaments are, you know, super chill. Never had one bite, and they've got these crazy, you know, big bug eyes. Round pupils, which I guess most colubrids probably have round pupils versus the slit that pythons and boas have. But you know, the variability as far as the morphs, that's kind of interesting too, if that's your thing. But even if you're not, the normals, man, are just as nice to me as any of the morphs, you know. You're kind of obviously they're super, they weren't hard, at least for me, to breed. If that's where you want to go, you know, you can reach in, grab them, never have to worry about them biting. You know, I don't worry. People's kids come over, that's what I hand them, either a ball python or a Trans Pecos, you know, because I know they're not going to, you know, have a bad experience with them.
Awesome. Yeah. And they have the Trans Pecos kind of have those big, and they're not really bulgy, but like they have those big eyes, which make them kind of cute looking.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot of people who, you know, are not snake people. They come in the room and that's what stands out about the sub ox to them is the eyes and how big the eyes are compared to the, you know, to the head. They almost look like, you know, out of proportion a little bit.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, cool, man. Well, Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap this up?
Man, support US ARC.
Yes, definitely. All right. Well, Marshall, it's been an absolute pleasure. There's been a bunch of people floating in and out through the live chats. What do you have to say to everyone who is watching tonight, anyone who's going to watch the replay and all that good stuff?
No, I appreciate everybody tuning in, and thanks for having me. It's, you know, fun talking about stuff that I don't normally talk about. You know, like I said, I'm not my experience with colubrids is pretty minimal. Don't know as much maybe as even I should, but they're, you know, I like them, man. They're cool. I feel like there's a shift happening in the hobby now with, you know, where in the next, you know, I don't know how long it'll take, 5 years, 10 years, who knows? But I think the shows are going to go from, you know, not seeing 75% ball pythons at every table to having a lot more variety. And obviously with the colubrids, there's just so many ways you can go, so many different species, so many different morphs. You know, the ease of keeping them compared to, not necessarily that they're easy, but you don't need as much equipment. You're not as worried about the heat. You're not, you know, they're just an easier animal to deal with than a python. Yep. or something that's tropical, you know? So
yeah, for the most part, I mean, you're spot on.
Yeah. The hobby I think is going to go kind of in that direction. You know, whether it be colubrids or different species of pythons and boas that are not worked with now. But I think the days of ball pythons being as dominant as they are, will probably, I mean, they're never going to fizzle out, obviously, but they will, they'll be less, prominent, I think, in the future.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think we're maybe starting to see that. I know there's been a definite shift over the last couple of years. I've been seeing colubrids gain more and more popularity. And I genuinely think that's going to keep growing. That's part of what this show is about, is, you know, trying to help grow that segment of the hobby. So I think we're going to keep seeing it. So it should be cool.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, all right, man. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate it. I'm going to run the outro real quick. If you want to hang out in the backstage, we'll talk for a couple minutes after.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Joe. Having me on. Thanks, man.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, what another fantastic episode of the Colubrid Corruption podcast. Marshall is a wealth of knowledge. It was great having him on today. I really appreciate him doing that. And yeah, guys, if you enjoyed, make sure you hit like on today's episode. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Again, we just passed that 1,000, but trying to gain some more. Keep growing the channel. Keep growing the podcast. Go listen to this on all your major audio platforms like Apple, Spotify. Leave a 5-star rate and leave a review if you can. Say what you like about the show. I saw a couple 4-star reviews. That sucks. Go give it a 5-star and get that back up. But yeah, guys, also you can follow me on all major social media at Meteoric Serpents everywhere. And thank you again to Show Me Reptiles Show and Marketplace for sponsoring today's episode. But yeah, guys, this has been another fantastic episode of the Colubrid Corruption podcast. Again, this was episode number 43 with Marshall Mendez from Red Mountain Herp. Hope you all have a fantastic night and a great week, and I'll see you on the next one. Peace.